Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The 1958 B-movie Daddy-O didn't really contribute much to American culture, except for two things. It was grist for an episode of Comedy Central's Mystery Science Theater 3000, especially the film song Rock Candy Baby.
Boysenberry is sweeter than coffee.
It's not bad.
Toffee, sweeter than jam. It's candy jam.
He's rock singing the left side of the menu.
Woo. Yeah. Rock, candy baby. Rock, candy baby. Rock, candy baby, you're mine.
It was also the film scoring debut of John Williams, who is now arguably considered the greatest movie composer of all time. Williams has scored more than 100 films, three of which are on the American Film Institute's list of the greatest movie scores in American cinema. 1982's E.T. ...1974's Jaws. And topping the AFI's list as the greatest film score ever, 1977's Star Wars. You only need to hear that first note to know it's Star Wars, to picture the opening crawl against the starry backdrop. The Star Wars score, as well as those for E.T. and Jaws, won Oscars for Williams, who has the second most Academy Award nominations of anyone, second only to Walt Disney. John Williams' legacy isn't just on the silver screen. There's his music for NBC News, the Olympics, and the list goes on. But it will be his relationship with Star Wars for which John Williams will be remembered the most. A relationship that he says will be ending with the release of the newest Star Wars installment, The Rise of Skywalker. Davidson College music professor Neil Lerner says history will consider the recordings of John Williams some of the most important and interesting music to come out of the 20th and 21st centuries.
So, this hour, as we consider the music of John Williams and its legacy, Neil Lerner joins us in our studio. Welcome back. And you brought a keyboard with you this time.
Yep.
Well, there it is. Thank you for being here. And Frank Lehman is an associate professor of music at Tufts University who keeps an online catalog of the musical themes of Star Wars. And he joins us from Massachusetts via Skype. And you just told me off the air, Frank, that you're doing a book with our other guest here this morning, Neil.
That's right. Yeah. Neil and I have collaborated in the past, and there are few more insightful film musicologists in the world than him.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this. We have two music professors, highly knowledgeable and skilled, and we're talking about John Williams, who is a movie music guy, and we're talking about him because the new Star Wars film is coming out right now. Movie buffs love his music, but you're both academics, and you're both connecting in a world that includes Mozart and Brahms and Beethoven and Bach, and the list goes on. What attracted you both to the music of John Williams? And I'll start with you, Neil, because you're facing me here.
Thanks. And thanks, Frank. You're doing really amazing work as well. And you're getting the field a little bit behind me because I'm older, and it's just been really exciting to watch your work develop and all the stuff you're doing. So It's great to be able to talk to you this morning. So John Williams, as a figure in music history, is part of what probably led me to writing about film music when I was a grad student in the first place. I know that just as a kid in the 70s, when the first Star Wars music came out, I was really excited about that music. It affected me and left an impression on me unlike any music I'd really heard before. And it's part of why I then got interested in orchestral music and played in orchestras and played piano and did other things. And I didn't know when I went to grad school as a musicologist that I would want to study film music. But once I started studying musicology and music history, it occurred to me in the 1990s when I was doing this, there was still very little being written about film music at all. Mm. And there were really just a couple of scholars who'd already started to pioneer into this area. But I expected I would show up and find books and articles on John Williams and
not so.
Very little.
Until Frank came along, because you've written a lot about John Williams. What attracted you to him as well?
Well, it's a similar story to Neil. I had formative experiences growing up. I think for me, things like Jurassic Park, Home Alone, and especially you mentioned the NBC News nightly theme. Mm-hmm. As a toddler, I would hear that playing on my parents' TV set and kind of know exactly that, you know, it's time to go to bed or something like that. His skill for creating these little earworms, even then, even as someone who probably wasn't even able to speak English yet, left an indelible impact on me. And I also discovered that, you know, going to grad school, that film and film music was a really open area for study, and in particular, the sort of close, detailed analysis of the musical score was something that really was in its infancy as a kind of scholarly discipline. So that's what I've latched on to, really digging into the materials here of musical composition.
John Williams was here and writing for movies long before Star Wars, but it was Star Wars, I think, most of us came to know him, because that opening, the opening note of Star Wars is so iconic. I remember distinctly sitting in the movie theater on the premiere weekend of Star Wars, not knowing really what to expect, but I'd seen some trailer, you know, material, and I thought, this is going to be cool. And that music exploded into the theater. And right then, bang, first note, this is going to be great. And it was.
Sure. And one thing, not to take anything away from John Williams, but this was also the introduction of some new sound reproduction technologies they were using.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because that note, that opening theme was so revelatory, not only because of the music, but because of the way it was recorded. And I was going to ask about that. Is that something, did he just come along serendipitously at the dawn of digital recording, or was that something that he and producers worked on to achieve that had never been done?
That's right. No, there's a scholar at University of South Carolina, Julie Hubbard, who's doing a lot of work on this, on the way that the actual recording practices mm-hmm. were changing. And so I think part of it is Williams and Star Wars just hit at sort of the right moment. And George Lucas was very interested in creating this much higher fidelity sound playback.
Because it was like, I remember distinctly thinking, this is like nothing I have ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
Even in a recording of the Boston Symphony, you just couldn't hear every single, it seems like you could hear every single instrument.
That's right. No, the clarity, the way that orchestra sound is spread across the left to right spectrum that you've got, it's really just incredible.
And if you listen carefully, when that first note does, it explodes from the center and moves to the left and right in an instant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, boom, you're in the galaxy. It's amazing. Frank, Steven Spielberg says it was John Williams who talked him into the music that ended up in Jaws. And you say that George Lucas originally wanted to borrow from Stanley Kubrick, who used traditional classical music, mostly from Strauss, I think, in 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's what he wanted to do. But Steven Spielberg talked him into hiring John Williams to do an original score. How different how different would that movie have been, Star Wars, had it not been for John Williams?
A completely different musical and cultural phenomenon, I think. Lucas had heard, as so many other people had, the incredibly interesting and effective use of pre-existing classical music in Kubrick's 2001. That was the specific sci-fi model. And like so many other things in Star Wars, is, you know, sort of cobbled from other genres and put together references and allusions to all sorts of previous film texts. And what he wanted to do was the same thing with the musical soundtrack. Use Holst, use Stravinsky, all this, you know, already written music. Mm-hmm. And Spielberg who was at that point close with Lucas, convinced him that his movie would be better served with originally written music that maybe emulated or modeled itself upon some of these temporary tracks of the Planet Suite from Holst or The Rite of Spring. And he said, well, I have this up-and-coming, not so up-and-coming, actually. Williams had been quite prolific even up to that point, you know, 45 or so years old. But he convinced him to write new music that could better suit the movie and to adjust itself to the various needs of any given scene, to provide characters with unique themes. And sure, there are now still very easily audible references to Holst and Korngold and Elgar and all these people that Lucas initially envisioned the soundtrack revolving around, but it's pure Williams as well, and yeah. The movie is so much more effective for it.
It's Charlotte Talks, and we're talking about John Williams, the composer, today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I think every great composer has a sound. You can't get away from it. You can readily identify the music of Mozart or Bach or Beethoven or Stephen Sondheim, for that matter. They have their little shticks. I don't know what else to call them. I guess it's just the chemical reactions in their brain when they sit down to write. They have their sound. So if an orchestra starts playing John Williams, it's almost instantly recognizable. Neil, why? What is it?
Some of this, you're describing what really sounds like a 19th century romantic phenomenon, this idea that a individual composer style is really linked to them as an individual and their own subjective emotional experience. And really coming from Beethoven onwards, this sort of idea that composers have distinctive sounds. And Williams actually employs a variety of different musical languages and different sounds. And so his most well-known sounds are these very late romantic sounds, the big Richard Strauss or Erich Wolfgang Korngold kind of sounds that we hear a lot in Star Wars. These heroic.
You have a keyboard. Can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
I've got some examples. So King's Row, the Korngold score for King's Row that was released in 1942 sounds an awful lot like Williams. And in fact, one of the pleasures when I'm teaching my film music course at Davidson is the first time I play this for current day college students, and just to get to watch their faces and their reaction as they hear Korngold's music and start to put together, wait a minute, this sounds a lot like John Williams, and what to make of that.
So he ripped him off?
that's a frequent argument that one finds out there, that he's just a plagiarist of some type. I would argue that he's not. I would argue he's actually, you know, threading a needle in a really complicated way of being able to make it sound like Korngold, but it's still his own sound.
Okay. Because everybody borrows things,
right,
from things that they have heard. You can't help it, right?
Sure.
And I guess although he's probably one of the greatest movie music composers ever, Frank, I would think that, and we have 30 seconds here, I would think that he's building on what came before, like Max Steiner and people like that, right?
That's right. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of not just film music history, not just classical music history, but pretty much all the popular genres in 20th century music as well. It's often forgotten, but he started out as a jazz pianist and spent decades actively performing in various studio albums.
It's not only forgotten. I didn't know anything about that. We'll come back and talk about that and where he fits into the pantheon of music composers in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars. Give me the Star Wars, don't let them end.
Oh, gosh, yes. That shows you how iconic that music was at the time. Bill Murray on Saturday Night Live in his lounge lizard act in which he sings the theme from Star Wars. Who would have thought? Neil Lerner is here. He's the chair of the Department of Music at Davidson College. And Frank Lehman is associate professor of music at Tufts University and the author of the complete catalog of the musical themes of Star Wars. They're all with us in the moment here. You were talking before the break, Neil, about borrowing, about leaning on the music that came before John Williams. John Williams actually doing this, and you play these in class, and people go, "That sounds like John Williams," but it's not. So you brought some examples.
Sure, that's right. Some comparisons between Korngold's music for King's Row, which starred Ronald Reagan, came out in 1942, sort of melodrama about a small town in the Midwest, and the story goes that Korngold composed this without knowing anything other than the King's title. Than the film's title of King's Row, and thought, King's Row, that sounds like something regal and majestic. We need big brass fanfares and so on, and wrote the theme that way. And it's a very different way to depict a small town in music, as contrasted with the way Aaron Copland would do that at just about the same time in the 40s, which is what we're used to.
So let's hear that piece of music. Wow.
I got to see your face do what my students do just now.
That's pretty brazen. Was he consciously aware of that, do you think?
I don't know that if he's ever said in an interview that he was specifically aware of King's Row.
Yeah.
There's evidence that he was pointed to Korngold.
You mentioned that Korngold wrote that having not read the script, only knowing the title of the film, and so the music, by all measures, should be incongruous to. And does it work in the context of the film? Gives it a different feeling, but does it work?
It does. It's actually it's really over the top. It really makes it seem over exaggerated. It's a melodrama already.
And I know that John Williams does not read the scripts to the movies he's scoring. He watches the dailies and he watches the rough cut of the movie and sits down with the director and decides where music goes, and then he writes that music. Is that how it works, Frank?
Yeah. He prefers to experience the film as an audience member would, with the surprise that comes with seeing characters have twists revealed, in sort of real time. And part of his talent, I think, is being able to translate these very intuitive emotional responses into just exactly the right musical cue or gesture.
You brought in another example of borrowing that John Williams has done, is that right?
No, this is actually the John Williams music to compare with the Korngold.
Okay, I'm sorry. We kind of interrupted that comparison. So we heard the Korngold just a second ago. Here's the John Williams. Of course. We should have played them back to back. And we're going to talk about John Williams and how he writes, because he still writes by pen and ink on paper, and he doesn't use synthesizers, and he does it the old-fashioned way every single day. And he's written every day, 6 days a week in his 70-some years. And you talked, Frank, earlier about his starting out as a jazz pianist. He's done a lot of things. He wrote that terrible song we played at the beginning, Rock Candy Baby, which was sung, by the way, by 1950s accordion star Dick Contino. He's done a little bit of everything. So how does doing a little bit of everything lead to him becoming the preeminent film composer of our time?
Well, it took a long time for him. He started out, like I said, as a pianist. He was trained both classically, but also in jazz clubs in L.A. and New York in the 1950s, and started out, like many people do, sort of at the bottom of the ladder in terms of importance. He would, well, before even doing horrible B-movies like Daddy-O, he would be a session musician. He played the piano in To Kill a Mockingbird or Some Like It Hot. You can actually sort of see him in some of those scenes.
Wow.
And as his obvious talent became more and more apparent, I mean, he was arranging for artists like Mahalia Jackson and Frankie Lane, and has a quite extensive discography from the 1950s and 60s that few people are even aware of now.
Tell me he didn't write Rawhide. Please tell me
he didn't write Rawhide, the theme for that was Dmitri Tiomkin, but he did actually a really wonderful arrangement for it on one of those
Mancini. Henry Mancini, right? And actually, Williams, the piano part, the famous boom, 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 boom,
right.
That's Williams on the piano.
You say, Neil, that despite his accomplishment and the popularity of his music among film lovers, at least, he's still not as appreciated, shall we say, by classical music aficionados. And that seems a little ironic when you consider that his music is the closest to classical music that most average Americans ever come to. And they go to concerts by symphony orchestras to hear them play his music. Should they not be tipping the hat a little bit more to him?
I suspect they will be. And I mean, at this point, if an orchestra programs some music by John Williams, that's generally a concert that they'll sell tickets.
I mean, he's keeping orchestras alive. Should they not be grateful? Seriously.
So we're talking, on the one hand, the idea of going an autonomous orchestra performance, of just going and watching musicians on a stage playing orchestra music. And that has a rich history and wonderful music. But starting in the 20th century, we became accustomed to hearing that sort of music while watching a story on a screen.
Here's what John Williams says about the kind of movie music that he writes. He calls it a kind of connective tissue, a glue between cultures. He says, today we have fantastic art music being created over here, talking about his stuff. And over here, pop music that's ubiquitous and permeates everything. There's an enormous gap between these two universes. And if we need a tissue that would somehow connect it, it seems to be more and more film music, which is creating the glue, a binder between the vernacular and the music of art. What's your take on that, Frank?
Well, it's hard to overstate just how important Williams has been in bringing film music into the concert hall. A lot of this has to do with his tenure at the Boston Pop starting in the early 1980s, where he inherited it from Arthur Fiedler. And of course, there had been precedents in the Hollywood Bowl and with Andre Previn and Charles Gerhardt before that of doing concert performances of music from movie soundtracks. But he made it part of his mission, really, to elevate this music and have one of the finest orchestras in the world perform it on a regular basis, including, you know, a fair share of his music, music arranged for those specific musicians.
You know, when you listen to the music from Jaws or Star Wars or Indiana Jones or Jurassic Park, the music, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, the music tells you what the movie's about. The music tells you who the characters are and what kind of person they are. How many other composers have that ability? Is that unique to John Williams?
Well, if you start to pull in the world of opera, it's not a unique ability at all. And there's a long history of composers who have done that. So part of what interests me about John Williams is to understand Williams as an extension of this tradition of orchestra music, but also opera, of traditions of music that can convey emotion, that can tell a story. And in this way, even though it's not done in an autonomous situation where people go and just watch people in tuxedos and black dresses perform orchestra music, he's keeping that tradition alive.
Well, he's said to have been heavily influenced in his music for Star Wars, I think, by Wagner and from other opera composers, and particularly in his use of the leitmotif, which is what we're going to talk about here, a distinctive musical signature for every major character that can be adapted in various ways as the stories evolve. And in this case, as the story has evolved over the course of 9 films, jumping back in time and forward in time. Was he the first to do that in film, Frank?
Not at all. There's actually, it was a very firmly established precedent during what's called the classical Hollywood era, 1930s and 40s, by composers like Korngold and Steiner. They kind of adapted this procedure that had come out of 19th century opera and Wagner specifically, and it really suits film, right, where you have a kind of short attention span to deal with on the audience's behalf. So having these small, recognizable, malleable little musical symbols trace the characters' journeys through a film is extremely useful for the craft of film composition. But it had gone out of favor, this leitmotif technique, during the 60s and 70s, when film musical trends and cliches had sort of changed more to be in favor of popular music and scores that were based around songs.
So you say there are 55 I think this is right, 55 distinct leitmotifs that point toward characters, objects, ideas, and relationships that run through the Star Wars series. Does he do the same thing in Indiana Jones, in Jurassic Park, etc.?
Well, it kind of depends on the needs of the specific film. So the four Indiana Jones films do employ leitmotif, not quite as extravagantly, I would say, as Star Wars. There are certainly recognizable melodies and themes in Jurassic Park or other, well-known movies, but maybe don't quite strive for that Wagnerian ideal where the music is really quite centered around those motifs and they develop and transform in interesting ways.
So that people know what we're talking about, Neil, you brought a keyboard. I'm told you're going to play a few of these motifs that we might recognize and tell us what they're attached to in these films.
Let's see. Is that
that's the Darth Vader.
That's right.
Dun, 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 dun.
So that only first appears in Empire Strikes Back. He hadn't written that yet in the first one in Star Wars. And then the prequels give him a chance to look ahead, to develop into that theme, into the Darth Vader theme. So the big love theme that we have for Anakin and Padme in the prequels has this. So that opening chord in that love theme, it's got the same harmonic movement in major because it's still happier and lighter and romantic, but we've got the sort of germ of the Darth Vader theme in that love theme that Williams writes for him.
I want to switch gears for a second. We talked a lot about Star Wars because that is where cut his bones, so to speak, and where that sound established itself, because he's famous for being able to capture the enormity of the human endeavor, whether it's on Earth in Indiana Jones or whether it's in outer space in Star Wars. He wrote the breathtaking score of the story of our lifetimes, the World War II story of the Holocaust, a breathtaking score for Schindler's List. The theme, as played by Itzhak Perlman, captures that aching heartbreak just perfectly. Unspeakable sorrow of what that movie is about. Is this because the violin is the instrument that comes closest to the human voice? Is that what's going on here? Is that why we feel it there? Or is there something else at work?
Well, there's quite a lot of things structurally and emotionally happening in this theme. It's actually a soundtrack as a Jewish person, I very rarely listen to because it's so painful. It's not something I've studied in depth like some of his other scores, but he often writes for specific musicians, and I think that the connection with Perlman here is very deliberate. He's kind of channeling a sort of Eastern European Jewish musical sound, also filtered through people like Bloch and Mahler, and it's an exquisitely refined piece of music, really, in all the details, music harmonically and rhythmically. It's very, very sensitive and beautifully crafted, but like I said, quite harrowing to listen to, whole score.
I think if you didn't know what that movie was about and you just heard that music without knowing that it was connected to a film, it would make you cry. It's that heartbreakingly aching. We're talking about the music of John Williams, whose new Star Wars movie, the latest one, will probably be his last participation in the Star Wars series. Today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Schindler's List, it's quiet, it's completely different, however, from the quiet and contemplative piece that he wrote for the relationship between Han Solo and Princess Leia. There are echoes of something that says Star Wars in this. Maybe it's the French horns, maybe it's the underscoring of the violins below the French, I don't know. But some say there are also echoes of the romantic theme of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake in the piece. Neil, that's from the second film in the original trilogy, The Empire Strikes Back. You say that score is considered to be the high watermark of the Star Wars franchise. Why?
I think it's... They're all effective in different ways. They're all really wonderful in different ways. I just found this one to be the score where he really started to move into some new and different directions that he hadn't done yet in the first Star Wars film. So we get the theme for the Darth Vader, the Imperial March, and we have this love theme. And, you know, Tchaikovsky, I also hear Tchaikovsky filtered through Max Steiner and the way Steiner would do a big romantic soaring melody like that in the French horns in something like his music for Gone with the Wind, for instance. And
We've talked a lot about Star Wars. There's also Jaws. Jaws would be nothing without those boom, boom, boom. You knew when you heard that the shark was coming or something bad was coming. When he wrote the music for that, when he wrote the music for Star Wars, did he set the musical template for every action film that has come down the pike since?
I know Frank actually has written a lot on
okay,
this.
Okay, well, let me take Frank, go ahead, because we have a minute left. That's all we got.
Well, there was definitely a lot of imitators following Star Wars. You can hear it even in Star Trek. You know, that competing franchise begins to resemble in its musical details a lot more sort of this extroverted heroism that Star Wars introduces. When we hit the 80s, there are a couple competing schools. Like, you hear a lot more synthesizers and the sort of, to use an example that's recently relevant, Top Gun has a kind of very different score than Star Wars. But his model of very heavily thematic, melodic, and ear-catching music has persisted through adventure and sci-fi and fantasy, you know, up to the current day.
Frank Lehman is Associate Professor of Music at Tufts University, the author of the complete catalog of the musical themes of Star Wars, and Neil Lerner, Chair of the Department of Music at Davidson College, and you thought it was just movie music. No, we're in college today on Charlotte Talks. John Williams' music for Indiana Jones. Great music. And once again, the piercing trumpet, the little tinkling bells at the very top, which you really do need a big theater sound system to fully appreciate. That's what he's done. He's written for those big booming speakers. You see, there's a reason to go to the movies and not just watch it on your little TV set. Neil Lerner is here. He's the chairman of the Department of Music at Davidson College. Frank Lehman is Associate Professor of Music at Tufts University and the author of the complete catalog of the musical themes of Star Wars. We're taking you to college today, and Wesley on Facebook says, if it weren't for high school band, I wouldn't know who you guys were discussing. My freshman year in high school, our halftime show in marching band was the music of John Williams. And I don't think that his experience is all that rare. There might be a lot of moviegoers who love Star Wars who have no clue who wrote the music.
I'm sure that's the case. And I'm sure they would have even less of an idea of who Korngold was or Richard
right.
Strauss or Tchaikovsky or some of the other names we've mentioned.
So what does that tell you about our cultural education in America?
Oh, that's a more painful conversation. I'm happy you're talking about John Williams. And that's, you know, I feel more joy when I talk about John Williams than I do when I talk about the state of arts education.
You want to chime in on that, Frank, before we move on?
I will say that discussing film music, we have to remember that oftentimes it's supposed to not be consciously noticed by the audience, right? That it's supposed to work its magic while not removing you from the immersive experience of watching a movie.
Right.
Williams' music maybe is a little bit more foregrounded and assertive in its musical presence than some other styles of music for film and television and so on. But I guess we can forgive the average film goer for not humming along knowingly as we do as college professors to this music.
Well, movie music is supposed to lead you. It takes your ear and leads you to where the director wants the story to go and what he wants you to see and understand about the story and the characters and the place, etc. And one of the songs that we've talked about, one of the pieces that we've talked about already a little bit, The Empire Strikes Back, Imperial March, which is Darth Vader's music, as you said, was not in the first movie. And I'm told, I read, and I don't know whether one of you wrote this or I was reading something else, that if you watch Star Wars and the entrance of Darth Vader in The Empire Strikes Back without the music, you see this big guy, this lumbering dude in this long cape and these jack boots and this black helmet walking in, and it looks like he might trip on something and fall over, but not when you put this music under that entrance. You hear that music, and you see that character walk into the film, and you want to scatter like rats. And it's called The Imperial March. Is there something about that, when you sit down to write a piece of music that does that, could you do it any other way?
Well, so you're actually making a really important point about film music and what it's doing and how it works. And you actually talked about the idea of leading a viewer, an audience member, to an idea. And this word leitmotif is from the German leiten, to lead. A leading motif was what Wagner was developing and playing with. And we could test your idea about Empire Strikes Back very easily just by turning the volume down and watching it.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think it would be a completely different scene. And the other way around, an exercise I do at the start of my film music classes will be to play film music without images and ask my students, what's going on? What do you think is happening? What kind of characters? What's the setting? What's the mood? And they nail it. They know these codes. They understand it from watching movies and seeing media. They probably won't be able to say, well, I think this part sounds like Coppola and this part sounds like Strauss.
Opera composers use leitmotifs. So does Stephen Sondheim. So does the music from Les Mis. And one of the things that I noticed about the music of Les Mis, each character has their own sound, their own little leitmotif that comes in, sometimes in the underscoring, sometimes in what they're actually singing. But then it has the ability to all come together and be played at once in some of these group numbers where all the characters are there. You hear their leitmotif, then you hear somebody else's, and it's on top of each other. You have to really plan that out because harmonically it has to work. I don't know if you've noticed, but there are echoes of the Empire's Strikes Back and the Imperial March in something we've also talked about, something Americans hear every single night, at least some of them do. So first, can you go back and play the Imperial March again? Let's play just a snippet of that. Okay, now here's what NBC Nightly News listeners hear every night. just for, so people know, he wrote the music for that. He wrote NBC's election theme. He wrote Meet the Press's theme. And there's a long, extended, symphonic version of the NBC Nightly News theme that goes for about 3 or 4 minutes that they occasionally play pieces of or use to close the newscast. And you said earlier in the program, Frank, that, that listening to that piece of music was probably your first exposure to John Williams, watching your parents' TV. How unusual is it for a composer of John Williams' caliber to be writing TV news themes? You hand that out to a jingle writer.
Well, you know, he elevates the art of jingle writing to that of, you know, I don't want to say Beethoven proportions, but that suite that you mentioned of the various NBC news pieces from Nightly News and Meet the Press and a couple other now forgotten news magazine shows from the 80s right. is really quite impressive. I mean, he's weaving in very complex harmonic structures, and there's a fugue or two in some of these pieces, you know, ancient and very learned types of musical procedures. So, while he's an extraordinarily humble and kind of modest person who would never, you know, assert that what he's doing is anything really other than writing jingles, the fact is he approaches these assignments with the utmost seriousness, and sometimes you can hear him just relishing and adding musical complexity to things that, you know, barely going to register for the average audience.
As in everything we talk about on this and every other program in the known universe, there's a video on YouTube of the actual recording of John Williams in a Los Angeles studio with a 100-piece orchestra recording the NBC Nightly News theme. I mean, that is monstrously expensive. Evidently, he was reluctant to do this, to take on this NBC project, because he thought it was too complicated, because the same piece of music would be played night after night after night, as opposed to a movie where you just hear it every now and then. You maybe only hear it once or twice in your entire life, but every night they hear that piece. It's one of those earworms that you talked about earlier in this. And he was following in the footsteps of the previous composer of the NBC Nightly News theme, who was Henry Mancini. So he was in good company. One of you, and I can't remember which, notes that the three prequel scores, the ones that came after the first three movies, are different from the first three scores, and they're different from the films that are following the first three, because they did them out of order. The middle sequence is the first series of three. Then they did the prequels. Now they're doing the afterwards, and they're all different. But is there some unifying theme in them?
There are several themes that are coming over that you hear in all of the films that we've heard in all eight so far, and I'm sure we'll hear in the ninth one. Frank has actually written some. I'm curious to hear what he'll say on that too.
Okay, Frank.
Yeah, well, the prequels, you have to remember, Williams was writing this, you know, 20 or so years after he had thought he had finished writing his last Star Wars score with Episode 6, I guess, Return of the Jedi. So he came back to this assignment with a matured and evolved musical sensibility. I mean, it's still all recognizably Williams. The orchestral palette is largely the same. He makes use of chorus quite a bit more in the prequel trilogy, giving it maybe even more of an epic or mythological sort of ambience to it, sonically speaking. And it has to be said that the music, it has a big duty to try to sort of compensate for some of the, I guess you could say, writing shortcomings of those movies, whatever your opinion is of them. The music seems to be doing, you know, working overtime to
well, let's make talk, it work. Let's talk about that, because when you have done one movie and it's been the penultimate score ever written, it seemed like at the time. And then they come back to you and say, "Oh, by the way, we're going to do another movie. Would you do the music?" Okay. And oh, by the way, we're going to do a third. Okay. Oh, and by the way, we're going to go back in time, and we're going to do three more. And oh, by the way, we're going to do three more after the first three. That's nine films. How does a composer approach that without repeating himself? There are certain things you do want to repeat, like the themes, the motifs. But how do you achieve that? What kind of talent does that take to do it nine times?
Gosh, I'm. It's I can't conceive of it. I mean, it's really such a feat that's just happened in our lifetimes, and we've just maybe taken for granted that, oh, it's another Star Wars film. It'll be another John Williams score. And this has been this incredible thing to unfold in front of us over these decades.
And you say, Frank, that the music for this series, the Star Wars series, which has come out over the course of 40 years, is unprecedented and incredibly deep. Unprecedented because there's so many?
Well, unprecedented in just the sheer opportunity that Williams has been provided to continually revisit and revise and update and evolve these musical materials. I think the closest analogy would actually be back to the world of opera with Wagner's Ring Cycle. But even that was composed over the span of just a little bit under 40 years. So Williams he is doing something genuinely unprecedented. The more we see these, you know, movie franchises like Lord of the Rings or Marvel, this may be an evolving trend that is elsewhere, but he's the one who's done it now.
Why deep? You said it's incredibly deep. What makes it so?
Well, you hear a theme introduced in 1977, and over the course of these now 9 movies, it will never be exactly the same. So he has chances to sort of metamorphose some of these musical ideas in quite clever ways. He seems to relish this opportunity to be crafty.
So I think I hear in the music that's accompanied Ray in episodes 7 and 8, I've noticed some little musical details that refer back to the theme for the Emperor, and even some that refer back maybe to the Vader music.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that. So what do you hear in that?
So I hear that. If you take those notes, slow them down, drop them a couple octaves, you've got the Emperor's music.
Talking about the music of John Williams this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. The latest Star Wars film, number 9, The Rise of Skywalker, which is in theaters now, Williams says it will be his last. He says it's quite enough for him.
You said that before, though.
can anyone live up to what he's done? I mean, because you know that Disney, they own this now, and they will take this franchise till the 23rd century if they can. Will anybody be able to live up to him, or would other composers be well advised to say no?
Well, there's some pretty big shoes to fill, but we've already begun seeing what maybe a new path could be in some of these anthology films like Rogue One and Solo, which had scores by people other than John Williams, Michael Giacchino, and I think in particular John Powell's score.
Are they imitating him? I've not seen those. Are they imitating John Williams, or is it something new?
Well, with Powell, actually, there are some new sound palettes, and his sensibility, while still richly thematic and very sophisticated in terms of harmony and melody and so on, has a bit more of an updated, a little bit less old school vibe to it. And I think that's what's going to have to happen if this franchise is going to persist.
We talked a lot in this hour about Star Wars because the Star Wars theme is the anthem that will live on long before most of us are gone. But here are just some of the other movies you've probably seen that John Williams wrote the music for. The Poseidon Adventure, The Towering Inferno, Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Superman, Raiders of the Lost Ark in the Indiana Jones franchise, E.T., Home Alone, Schindler's List, JFK, Saving Private Ryan, The Patriot, AI, Artificial Intelligence, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer Stone, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, War Horse, Lincoln, and The Post, just some of the films people saw so they could hear John Williams' music, which is why, by the way, they have the Olympics every 2 years, so you can hear John Williams' Olympic music. I want to thank Dr. Neil Lerner, Chair of the Department of Music at Davidson College, Frank Lehman, Associate Professor of Music at Tufts University, and the author of the complete catalog of the musical themes of Star Wars, for telling us more about John Williams.
So
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.